We continue our studies in the Haftorah portions, and as you know, Haftorah is a word that means completion, and it's a section from the prophets that goes along with a weekly Torah portion. Now, this week's Torah portion is called Chaya Sarah, the life of Sarah. It's in Genesis, and it begins with Sarah's death and how Abraham purchased the field of Machpelah and the cave there from Ephron, and he buried Sarah there. And it goes on and covers some other issues, but then when you get to the end of the book, we see Abraham doing something that is striking. After Sarah dies, Abraham remarries, and he has a number of more sons, about six if I'm not mistaken. And the passage is in Genesis 25, verses 1 to 6. This is what it says. Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah. She bore him Zimran, Yokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shua. And then it goes on to tell about some of their sons and so on. And but anyways, before Abraham died, he had these six sons. We don't know how many daughters and how many grandchildren, possibly great-grandchildren. But then it says in verse 5, Abraham gave all he had to Isaac, but to the sons of his concubines, Abraham gave gifts. And while he was still living, he sent them away from his son Isaac eastward to the land of the east. This is one of the reasons why in the Eastern religions, in Taoism, in Buddhism, in Shintoism, you will find many teachings that are almost identical to the teachings of Torah. There have been books written that take some of the statements of Yeshua and the statements of Buddha, and they're almost word for word identical. Now, please don't hear me endorsing these Eastern religions as being a legitimate way to God. That's not what I'm doing. But there are definitely similarities, and this explains where those similarities came from. Abraham was an incredibly wise man, a prophet of God, who taught and discipled many souls during his lifetime. And he gave these gifts also to his sons, but then he sent them to the land of the east, and they carried these things, these teachings with them. But he gave everything else to his son Isaac. And this is the connection with this week's Haftorah portion, which is found in 1 Kings chapter 1. 1 Kings chapter 1, verses 1 to 31. So if you would turn there, please. 1 Kings 1, verse 1. What I'm going to do is read through the Haftorah portion and make a few comments as we go through. But then come back and address an issue that is right at the heart and foundation of everything that's wrong with you and me. So, 1 Kings chapter 1. As in our Torah portion, we see Abraham dying. In this Torah portion, we see King David dying. It says, King David was old, advanced in years. They covered him with garments, but he did not become warm. His servants said to him, let there be sought for my lord the king a young virgin, who will stand before the king and be his attendant. She will lie in your bosom, and it will be warm for my lord the king. They sought a beautiful girl throughout the boundary of Israel, and they found Avishag the Shunammite and brought her to the king. The girl was exceedingly beautiful, and she became the king's attendant, and she served him. But the king was not intimate with her. This is a story you're going to, it's going to be very unlikely to see a VeggieTales episode covering this one. And I know it's a shocking way to start a book of the Bible. And you think, what? Who does this? And but we have to realize these are not modern times. They didn't have electric blankets then. We're dealing with a king, not just a run-of-the-mill person. And there are several reasons that when you go through them, you can realize this was the wise and logical choice for that time and place for this individual, for King David. First of all, like I said, the There were no electric blankets. Rooms were not very warm. They covered him with lots of clothing and garments. It just wouldn't keep the heat in, because, after all, blankets and clothing don't produce heat. They're just to hold in what heat there is. And David, at this time of his life, his circulation must have been horrible because he simply could not get warm. So the way to keep him warm is to have someone close to him. Now, this person also attends them, sees to his needs, brings him his meals, takes care of the various things that are needed to be done. They're a servant, but also to sleep close to him to keep him warm. You think, well, first of all, how about his wife? Well, he had several, but these wives are considered queens. It'd be beneath them for them to be the attendants and to perform this duty. Of course, it'd be obviously inappropriate to have a man serve in this duty. It'd be inappropriate to have someone else's wife serve in this capacity. So they found a young virgin. And since he is the king, they found one who is very beautiful. And she would be his servant and also the one to keep him warm. And also, they must have figured that if there was physical intimacy, she would at least be qualified to become his wife. But as we know, there was none of that. Now, there are spiritual things going on here. If we had time, we would get into them. But you notice what family she's from? She's a Shunammite. She's a Shunammite. Someone emailed me during the week and asked about the Shunammite woman from last week's Haftorah portion, which is found in 2 Kings 4. And there are only two Shunammites mentioned in the whole Bible. This Shunammite virgin here in 1 Kings 1, and then the Shunammite woman who was barren over in 2 Kings 4. The only two. And someone emailed me and asked me, is it possible that they were Gentiles, or that the Shunammite woman was a Gentile? Of course not. They would not have had a Gentile woman come in to keep the king warm and to serve him. But the only two Shunammites in the Bible are this young girl here and then the woman in 2 Kings 4, which means God is saying you need to put the two together, compare them. It's a menorah pattern. If you do that, you compare their lives and what God does in them and through them, there's a picture to be painted here. Now, this Shunammite here, this young virgin girl, is mentioned again over in chapter 2. She comes into the story again as one of the main characters. We don't have time to get into that today, but you can read that as well. But there's an assignment for you. Take the two Shunammite women, compare their lives, and see what God teaches you. But we want to move on to what happens next. This is gets into the heart of the story in verse 9. I'm sorry, verse 5. Adonijah, son of Haggit, exalted himself. Now, Adonijah is David's fourth son. His first three sons are dead. So Adonijah is the eldest surviving son of David. And so he assumes, my father's old, he's about to die, I'm next to be king, let's go ahead and get this show on the road. Adonijah, son of Haggit, exalted himself, saying, I shall reign. Oh, whenever you see somebody say, I shall, that is filled, what follows is something about themselves. It's usually not good. It's usually not a good thing. As I was reading this, I was reminded of Isaiah 14, which I call the five I wills of Satan. Isaiah 14, verses 12 to 15. Listen to this. How you are fallen from heaven, O day star, son of dawn. How you are cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. I will set my throne on high. I will sit on the mount of assembly in the far reaches of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. But you were brought down to Sheol, to the far reaches of the pit. After all, God does resist the proud and gives grace to the humble. And if we, and whoever lifts himself up will always be humiliated. But whoever lowers himself in due time will be lifted up. So Adonijah had to learn this lesson the hard way. He said, I shall reign. He provided himself with chariot and riders and 50 men to run before him. I'm not sure what that was all about, but they ran in front of him. All his days, his father had never saddened him by saying, why have you done this? You know, David was a great king, but he wasn't a great success as a father. And it's amazing the number of men we find in the Bible, men like Samuel and Eli and others, who are great men in so many ways, but they failed at home in raising their children. Now, I understand that we're to be responsible parents. We do our best equipping our kids with the tools they need. But at some point along the way, our kids have to take ownership of those tools and begin to use them. Because after all, God's kids didn't turn out all that great either, and he's a perfect father. And so I'm not blaming David and Eli and Samuel, but here the scriptures are pointing out something David failed to do. His father never saddened him. He never rebuked him for anything he did. He never said, whoa, why are you doing this? Think this through. A comment by Rashi. He says, he who refrains from disciplining his child ultimately leads him to his death. He who refrains from disciplining his child ultimately leads him to his death. And of course, we're all familiar with the passage about rebuking the child and chasing the child with the rod and so on. And I do believe in corporal punishment. I believe that until a person is ready to understand things in their brain, God has provided a certain part of the anatomy that can receive some pain without doing any damage. But until a person can understand, physical pain is the only thing that can begin to get through. And I think the most foolish things I've ever seen is an adult trying to reason with a little child. It's like, come on, are you serious? So we need to learn how to use physical discipline in a wise way. But with that said, the scriptures say to rear up a child according to his way, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. And that is what it says in the Hebrew. Raise up a child in his way. In other words, if you have four or five kids, each one will need to be disciplined in a specific, tailor-made way for their personality and character. And as the child grows, you're going to see that character arise. You're going to find that one kind of discipline doesn't work with one child, whereas it does with another. There's not this one-size-fits-all. It means we must be extremely sensitive to the personality and the character within each child God gives us. And we must rear that child and discipline that child in that particular way for that child. You know, I learned this kind of late in life, but I want to pass it on to you, those of you who have little ones. Be very sensitive to the makeup of each child you have, and tailor make your discipline for that one. And you're going to, I think, have a lot more success. What else does it say here? Moreover, he was very handsome, and his mother bore him after Absalom. So he's a good-looking guy, and he's never been disciplined. He's next in line to be king. People follow him. He's a natural-born leader. I mean, everything logically says Adonijah's time to saddle up and start ruling. It says in verse 7, he discussed with Joab. Now, this is interesting. I like this word, he discussed. In Hebrew, it says, vayiyu davariv. In other words, he made words. He did words. Doesn't say he spoke. Doesn't say he reasoned. It doesn't say he sought out counsel. He just made words. So much conversation is just a matter of making words rather than really accomplishing anything of a spiritual nature. So he made some words with Joab, son of Zeruiah, and Abiathar the Kohen. So here he gets a military leader and he gets a priest, and they assisted following after Adonijah. But Zadok the Kohen, Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, who becomes Solomon's muscle, so to speak. As you read through 1 Kings, whenever Solomon had to have someone dealt with, it was Benaiah he sent after him to take care of it. So he was Solomon's right-hand man. Nathan the prophet, Shimei, Ray, and David's mighty men were not with Adonijah. It wasn't that they were against him or for him. It's just they were waiting for David to make a decision here. Who's going to be king next? In other words, they didn't just jump on the bandwagon because it seemed like a logical thing to do. They awaited a word from the king. We must be very careful to do the same thing. If David had said Adonijah is to be king next, they would have followed him. If David had just died without appointing a king, Adonijah is probably the one they would have followed. He was the next one in line. But as long as David was alive, they're awaiting a word from the king. They were patient. And then it says in verse 9, Adonijah slaughtered sheep, cattle, and fatted bull at the Zohelet stone, which is near Enrogel. I'm tempted to comment on those, but we don't have time today. And he invited all his brothers, the sons of the king, and all the men of Judah, the king's servants. But Nathan the prophet, Benaiah, the mighty men, and his brother Solomon, he did not invite. All of his other brothers he invites, but not Solomon. May I suggest that whenever you see something taking place, and the temptation is to jump on the bandwagon, listen to what is not being said, pay attention to what is not being done, and look at who is not being invited. And that will reveal an awful lot about the heart of the person who's taking control. You know, when you look at a Torah scroll, what you notice are all the black letters that are handwritten on the scroll. But the sages tell us that the black letters are black fire on white fire. They say the empty space also speaks. The white parchment behind the letters and around the letters also has something to say. In other words, don't just look at what is there. Look at what is not there. And that is part of the lesson here, I think, that God would have us learn. So he invites all these uppity-ups. They're all coming. But look who he doesn't invite. He doesn't invite Nathan, the prophet. You'd think that'd be the first person you go to. Say, Nathan, what should I do? I'm the next in line to be king. You gave my father wise counsel all his life. What should I do? He doesn't do that. Because I think he knows what the answer is going to be. He invites all of David's sons except for Solomon. Why? Because he knows there was this promise made way back at Solomon's birth, about 12 years earlier. Solomon's only about 12 years old at this point. There was a promise made that Solomon would be king. And you know that had to be kind of niggling in the back of Adonijah's mind. So I don't invite Solomon here. So, pay attention to what is not said, what is not done. That sometimes can speak volumes. Verse 11, Nathan spoke to Bathsheba, Solomon's mother, saying. Now, Bathsheba is an interesting name in Scripture because it's one of the few names. It's two words. It's not all stuck together. It's actually two separate words. Bat, which means daughter, like we have a bat mitzvah, daughter of the commandment. We have bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah. So bat is daughter. There's a space. Then the next word there is Shiva. And Shiva means oath. And you're going to find the word Shiva or oath a number of times here in the passage. So Bat Shiva means daughter of the oath. Now what is the oath? What's so interesting, we don't know of any oaths that Bathsheba is involved in. But there's an oath made when she gives birth to Solomon. And then there's some oaths made to her here. It's almost as if God, before she was ever born, knew that it would be the oaths that are made surrounding her offspring that would identify her as a character. Now here's what's so unusual about Bathsheba. It's going to be her son Solomon who becomes the next king, the greatest king of Israel. And yet, Bathsheba became David's wife through adultery and murder. You think of all the wives of David and children, Bathsheba would not even qualify to father the next king. And yet it's this woman who came into David's life through David committing adultery and murder. It's her child God chooses. God's ways aren't our ways, folks. And sometimes we see someone we think is a great holy man. Oh, that's the one God's going to pick. And then God picks some guy who seems to have nothing going for him, and that's the one God chooses. In fact, you find that pattern pretty often throughout the scriptures. Anyways, Nathan spoke to Bathsheba, Solomon's mother, saying, "Have you not heard that Adonijah, son of Haggith, has become king? But our Lord David does not know it. So now go, I will give you counsel now so that you may..." Now the word you may have in your Bibles is save or rescue. The word there is the word malat, which means to escape. So that your soul may escape. You may escape with your life and the soul of your son Solomon. So he tells her what to do. "Go and come to King David and say to him, 'Have you not, my lord the king, sworn?'" And there's that word, sheva. "Have you not, sheva, have you not sworn to your maidservant saying, quote, 'Your son Solomon will reign after me, and he will sit on my throne?'" Unquote. Why has Adonijah become king? Where is this promise made? Two places. Let's go to 2 Samuel, or you can just listen. 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 24. As you know, David committed adultery with Bathsheba, then had her husband killed, Uriah had him killed. Nathan comes to him and kind of reveals to David what he's done. And when David realizes what he has done, he repents. Bathsheba gives birth to a son who dies at birth. And then it says, "Then David comforted his wife Bathsheba and went into her and lay with her, and she bore a son and called his name Shlomo," Solomon, which means peace, or his peace, or peaceable. "And Adonai loved him and sent a message by Nathan the prophet." And sent a message by Nathan the prophet. It doesn't tell us here what that message was. "And so he called his name Yedidiah," which means beloved of the Lord. Why? Because of Adonai. So Solomon has two names, Shlomo, which means peaceable or his peace, and Yedidiah, which means beloved, Yadid, beloved. 1 Chronicles 22, however, gives us some more detail. This is a little later. It says, "Then he called for Solomon his son and charged him to build a house for the Lord, the God of Israel. David said to Solomon, 'My son, I had it in my heart to build a house to the name of Adonai, my God, but the word of Adonai came to me saying, you have shed much blood and have waged great wars. You shall not build a house to my name because you have shed so much blood before me on the earth. Behold, a son shall be born to you who shall be a man of rest. I will give him rest from all his surrounding enemies, for his name shall be Solomon. And I will give peace and quiet to Israel in his days. He shall build a house for my name. He shall be my son, and I will be his father, and I will establish his royal throne in Israel forever. Now, my son, Adonai be with you, so that you may succeed in building the house of Adonai your God, as he has spoken concerning you." So this is harkening back to an earlier time where David begins to share what God has spoken to him, what he has spoken to him through Nathan the prophet concerning Solomon. So let's return now to 1 Kings. Bathsheba has been given instructions by Nathan. So we'll pick it up in verse 14. And Nathan says, "While you are still speaking there with the king, I will come in after you and supplement your words." Verse 15. So Bathsheba came to the king, entered the chamber. The king was very old, and Abishag the Shunammite was serving the king. Bathsheba bowed and prostrated herself to the king. Now this is something normally a wife of the king would not do. She might bow to him, acknowledge him, treat him with grace and respect, but to prostrate herself on the floor, this is very unusual. So the king said, "What concerns you?" He knew right away there's something on Bathsheba's heart. So he says, "What concerns you?" She said to him, "My lord, you swore to your maidservant by the Lord your God, 'Only Solomon your son will reign after me, and he will sit on my throne.' But now, behold, Adonijah has become king, and now, my lord the king, you did not know. He has slaughtered ox, fatted bull, and sheep in abundance, and has invited all the king's sons, as well as Abiathar the Kohen, and Joab, the commander of the army. But he has not invited your servant Solomon. And you, my lord the king, the eyes of all Israel are upon you, to tell them who will sit on the throne of my lord the king after him. For it will happen that when my lord the king lies with his forefathers, I and my son Solomon will be deemed sinners." In other words, Solomon would pose such a threat to Adonijah that Adonijah would deal with him. He'd probably have him killed or at least put into exile, and Bathsheba as well. And then while she's talking, it says, "Behold, she was still speaking with the king when Nathan the prophet arrived. They told the king, saying, 'Nathan the prophet is here.' He came before the king and prostrated himself to the king with his face to the ground. Nathan said, 'My lord the king, have you said, Adonijah will reign after me and he will sit on my throne? For he has gone down today and slaughtered ox, fatted bull, and sheep in abundance. And he has invited all the king's sons, the generals of the army, and Abiathar the Kohen. And behold, they are eating and drinking before him. And they have said, Long live King Adonijah. But me, I, your servant, and Zadok the Kohen, Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, and your servant Solomon, he did not invite. Can it be that this matter has come from my lord the king, and you have not informed your servant who will sit on the throne of my lord the king after him?' Then King David answered and said, 'Summon Bathsheba to me.' She came before the king and stood before the king. The king swore," there's that word Sheva again, "the king swore and said, 'As Adonai lives, who has redeemed my life from every trouble, I swear,'" there's that word, of course it's in brackets, but that's what's inferred, "'that as I have sworn to you by Adonai, the God of Israel, saying, Solomon your son will reign after me, and he will sit on my throne in my place, so shall I fulfill it this very day.' Bathsheba bowed down to the ground and prostrated herself to the king. She said, 'May my lord King David live forever.'" And that's where the Haftorah portion ends. But it's tempting to read on to see what David does. He has Solomon put on his own mule and has every feast made and everybody go out and they have this huge party, and Adonijah is saying, "What's the noise? What's going on over there?" And then he says a big whoops. All right. You know, I was reading this and thinking, David's first great act that's recorded in scriptures is the slaying of Goliath. You know the story so well. He's a young boy, has the one stone in a sling, and goes out and slays this giant walking piece of blasphemy, Israel's enemy. And then here we have David's last great act as king. And this one, in many ways, is more important than the first one. He went and killed one man, a giant, yes, but he killed one man, and possibly the army of Israel could have gone out and done that. But only King David could set the entire direction for the history of Israel at this point by saying, "Not Adonijah, Solomon is going to be king." That set the course for Israel's history. That was a greater act than killing Goliath. May not have taken as much courage and bravery, and it doesn't make for as good a movie, but every bit is important. And this is why we need to learn to measure things for the results they have, not just for the glory and the drama of the moment. We all want to go out and kill the Goliaths and be carried around people's shoulders as the big hero. But here's a decision he makes in his bedroom before Nathan and Bathsheba, two people. I simply say, "Not Adonijah, Solomon." And what a powerful impact that decision had. much bigger one than the whole Goliath thing. That was small potatoes. When it comes to the fruit, when it comes to the impact of the action, this has a much, much, much greater impact than killing Goliath every could have. So let's talk about Adonijah. Adonijah is an interesting character because Adonijah is following logic. But he's following it with a healthy dose of ego and pride. And you know, nobody likes a proud person. A proud person may get admiration, but a proud person never has friends. Never really has loyal friends. We all recognize pride when we see it. Pride is when someone claims to be better than someone else. Faster, stronger, better sportsman, smarter, whatever. I'm better, I'm bigger, I'm stronger. We all see that. None of us like it. But what is the thing? What is the thing in us that lies behind pride? There's something much more subtle and much deeper. It's called the ego. I talked about this about a year and a half ago, and I was amazed at the number of people who commented on that, had more questions about it, wanted to read more about it. And so today we're going to go back and review a little bit what I taught a year and a half ago. And for those of you who are new, I hope this has the same impact on you that it did on me when I began to discover these things. And the reason I'm doing a lot of review and going back is because, as you know, my little granddaughter is with us for a couple of weeks, and so I spend every waking moment just playing with her and looking at her, and you folks come way down the totem pole. And so when it comes time to prepare, I dig out old notes, and that's what you get. I told Robin today's going to be chicken McNuggets, pieces, parts, from here and there, stuck together. But it still tastes good, I hope. These insights I'm about to share, most of them come from Rabbi Chaim Miller. And a few years ago, I listened to a lecture by him that, to me, just it's like light bulbs are popping in my brain. And I have found the information that he gave on the ego is so powerful, so scriptural, and gives me so much understanding into how I work and how other people work, because the ego is a universal issue, a universal problem. In Hebrew, the word for I, for me, is the word ani, aleph, nun, yud, three letters, ani. And in Greek, if you look in the Greek scriptures, if you read them in Greek, the word for I is the word ego, where we get the word ego. It's gamma, and it's omega. Just three letters, ego. But in English, we just say I. What's interesting about the Hebrew word, ani, aleph, nun, yud, and if the overhead was working, you could see it. If you take the last two letters and reverse them, so where it's aleph, yud, nun, it spells the word ain, which means nothing. It's a powerful lesson there. We should realize that the I, when I live according to it, it is nothing. When it's given away to the Lord, it can become something. Instead of just I, it becomes his, and that's a whole different dynamic. So, if you're taking notes, this is what you'd see on the screen. I'm giving five symptoms of ego in daily life. Five symptoms of ego in daily life. Number one, the ego is all about making myself right and others wrong. Now, I misunderstand. This is different from pride. Pride is boastfulness. But ego is something deeper, something more subtle. The ego is a false you. It's a false me. The ego is a lie. The ego is the soul we want to project to others and make them think this is who Grant Luton is or this is who so-and-so is. It's the way we act. It's not who we are, but it's how we act. It's not being humble. It could be acting humble. And I'm not interested in anyone acting humble. I want us to be humble. I'm not interested in people acting loving. I want people to be loving. And so the ego is an actor that plays a role. And it doesn't mind acting humble as long as somebody's watching. You know? It isn't my mind acting loving as long as it has an audience. It can do all kinds of good things provided there's sufficient reward, enough eyes watching, enough ears listening. So number one, the ego is all about making myself right and others wrong. The ego is always comparing itself with others. Because you see, the ego only has room for its own self. It doesn't have room for others. And that's why when you're in a room full of people, if your ego is, I'm a funny guy, you got to be the funniest guy in the room. And another person with a better sense of humor, you got to somehow put them down because they're robbing the spotlight from you. You got to be the smartest guy. And if there's someone else in there who seems to be smart, you think, because they're just arrogant. They're just boastful. They don't know anything. And I need to expose how stupid they really are so people can see, once again, I'm the smartest guy. Or the best-looking guy or girl. Then someone else comes into the room who's as good-looking or better. Well, they had plastic surgery. Well, that's this or that. And you have to belittle, because the ego never has room for someone else. Now, the true self always does. But with the ego, other people are there to serve your ego. They're there to applaud you. They're there to pay attention to you. Yes, Carla, see your hand up.
Are you saying that the ego, you're saying those things to yourself, to back yourself up?
Yes.
Stuff. Is that what you mean?
Sometimes it will expose itself publicly by... I mean, most of the time when you hear people cut people down with their words, either to them or behind their back, it's the ego talking. Oh, it's always ego talking. It has to reduce the other. Yeah. The ego doesn't have room for another. This, an interesting thing happens now when you find two people with big egos, a guy and a girl. What happens, the ego of the one wants the other, and the ego of this one wants this one. And when you get a guy and a girl who fall in love, which there's no love involved, but they fall in love because each looks at the other as one who can add to their own ego. My wife's better looking than yours. My husband's handsomer and smarter and he makes more money than yours. When you get two egos marrying, it's like atomic fusion. There's going to be a huge explosion here in a moment. It's going to fall apart because egos are phantoms. The marriage is built on nothing. You see? Because the same egos that thought, well, this other one can add to me, is the same thing that says, I'm tired of this person. They no longer boost my ego. I'm done with them, and then pushes them away. It happens all the time. Ego insulates the true souls from really connecting. And also, under this one, the ego is all about making myself right and others wrong. Kai Miller said something interesting. He said, ego equates self with thought. It equates the self with its thoughts. Another rabbi says this. I came across this quote just a week ago. He says, mistakenly, people measure themselves and those around them by their intellects. But the truth is that the intellect is a servant to one's desires. Is that interesting? And so smart people, or not so smart people, okay, oh yes, I should do that. I wish it was on the overhead so you can copy it. Mistakenly, people measure themselves and those around them by their intellects. But the truth is that the intellect is a servant to one's desire. In other words, even though you might think yourself the smartest guy in the world, you have an IQ through the roof, what really directs your path is something behind the intellect, and that's something your heart. In other words, if your heart decides you want A, your intellect will come along and find some way to justify you doing A. But if your heart decides it wants B, your intellect will come along as its servant to justify choice B. It's really the truth. This is why you find people who have very high IQs doing really stupid stuff, getting caught for it, and doing time in prison. And then you think, they weren't so smart after all. Yeah, they were. But their hearts were not harnessed. Their hearts were wild. Their hearts did not choose wisely. But the intellect comes along as a servant to the desire. Yes, Jim.
Is there a comment on seemingly obedient to be on his battles and everything, seemingly obedient to God, yet his denial of building a temple blamed on him being bloodthirsty?
Oh, well, that's a little different. I'm glad you brought up David, though, because that David did try to obey God. He really did. He's a man after God's own heart, we're told. But let me give you an example of where David used his intellect to serve a wrong desire. He's supposed to be out in battle, correct? Israel's winning. He goes home for a break. He's up on the roof of his palace. He looks down. He sees a woman bathing, Bathsheba. Bathsheba's a married woman. David already has several wives. He doesn't need another one. But his heart wanted that woman. So what does he do? He uses his intellect to come along and justify his desire. He sends a servant to invite her up, finds out, yes, indeed, she is a married woman, wife of Uriah, one of his soldiers out in the field. But here's how David's intellect comes along and justifies the sin. You see, men, when they would go out to battle, would always give their wives a bill of divorce, a certificate of divorce. This happens even today in Israel. Israeli soldiers, when they go into warfare, they give their wife a certificate of divorce. Because in Judaism, this is not in the Bible, but in Judaism, if a man dies and his body is not found, they cannot find his corpse, then there's no proof of death, and therefore his wife can never remarry. Until a body is produced, the woman cannot remarry. And so out of love, these men going into battle would give their wives a certificate of divorce until the war was over and come home, then they'd tear up the certificate. When the World Trade Centers came down, there's a case of an Orthodox Jew who's in the towers. He realized he's going to die. He gets on the phone, he calls his wife, he calls his best friend, and tells them both, I only have a few minutes left to live. I'm divorcing my wife. You're my witness. And sure enough, he died. They never found his body. But as an act of love, he divorced his wife so she could remarry later. So, in David's mind, he's thinking, oh, Uriah, yeah, he's her husband, but right now he's divorced. You see? So in his mind, it's not adultery. And then when Bathsheba becomes pregnant and the war is over, or Uriah comes home, he realizes, okay, we have an issue here. Well, I can deal with this. I'm the commander-in-chief of the army. I'll just put Uriah, I can put my men wherever I want. We'll lead him right into the thick of the battle, right at the head. And sure enough, Uriah gets killed. But again, in David's mind, he's the commander-in-chief. He can put his men wherever he wants, and Uriah gets killed. But when Nathan comes along and exposes what was really in his heart, here, you committed adultery, you committed murder. And David, when he saw it, is like, oh. See how the intellect can come along to serve the desire? The ego, though, is completely blind to that. Let's move on. I'm looking at this clock. It can't be right. But anyways, number two. The ego causes feelings of superiority and inferiority. The ego causes feelings of superiority, which is we see as arrogance and pride, but also inferiority. Now, we always recognize a person who's braggadocious, always bragging about how wonderful and great they are. But you know the ego can work just as effectively in people's like, oh, I can't do anything. Oh, nobody loves me. Oh, I'm a doormat. Please wipe your boots on me, you know. And people who do that, it's also sin. That's also ego. It's not the real self. You know, last week, my son and daughter-in-law were here, and they had little Maya, who's 6 months old, right? So I have them bring her up, and I'm holding her up here and wake her up, and she looks out. Is she nervous? No, not afraid. No stage fright, not at all. She looks out and she starts grinning. Why? She has no ego, zero ego, none whatsoever. She doesn't know how to act. She's just who she is. I think it's one of the reasons why the Master says we must become like little children that are the kingdom of God. They have no ego. So she's not trying to put herself out front. But she's not trying to cower in fear either. She says, here I am. She's happy about it. So the ego could cause feelings of superiority and inferiority. But the ego, what it does, there's this constant need to maintain the boundary of self. The ego is a way you put a boundary around the real you, because whether you realize it or not, you don't want people to know the real you, because you really feel the real you is lacking and wanting and deficient. So you have to put on this other thing. Either comes across as, I'm the best in this or this or this, or I'm just terrible, I'm just awful. But whatever it is, we want to hide the real self. It's a boundary to the self, the true self. Number three, the ego equates having with being. The ego equates having with being. We must have more to maintain the boundary of self. People who shop till they drop, they just cannot hold on to their money. They have to spend. This is the ego making you do this. Because the ego keeps saying, if I have more stuff, then this props up this face I want people to see. My car is nicer than yours. My house is bigger than yours. My lawn is better than yours. And blah, 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 blah. We want to have more and more stuff. And it's all ego. It's all a fantasy. It's all a phantom. Luke 12:15 says, take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Number four, the ego equates doing with being. You must do more to maintain this boundary of self. We have to do more and more and more. One rabbi said, if my life is filled with striving, this is the power of the ego. Is your life made up of striving? You're always struggling and straining to get the next thing done. That's ego. This is one of the beauties of the Sabbath. The Sabbath is a tool God's given us to be still, be quiet, to produce nothing. And in that stillness and quietness, we were talking about that during the prayer service some, gives us an opportunity to readjust our perspective and realize who we really are. And we do that by realizing who he really is. Everything comes back into balance. The ego takes a break. And week after week after week, as we come to pray, come to worship, and to be still, we can deal a death blow to the ego. Martha is one who thought that doing was being. In Luke 10:41-42, remember how Martha was getting hot under the collar because her sister Mary was sitting at Yeshua's feet while Martha's in the kitchen doing all the work? And so she complains. But the Lord answered her, Martha, Martha, you're anxious and troubled about many things, but one thing is necessary. Mary has chosen the good portion, which will not be taken away from her. And number five, the ego is the cause of all depression and unhappiness. The ego is the cause of all depression and unhappiness. You ever been unhappy? Ever been depressed? Guess what's right at the heart and core of all of it? It's the ego. You lose something. You lose a loved one, maybe a spouse. And you go into depression. Because you believed you deserved more time. Who said? The truly humble person will say, as Job did, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. The truly humble person, even though they're hurting and they're in pain, they don't go into depression because they thank God for the wonderful years they had together with their beloved. But the ego says, but you got shorted. You deserve more time. What am I going to do now? This isn't fair. Wah, 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 wah. You understand? I'm not saying you don't mourn. But to go into depression, that's ego. Every single time. Oh, I had a note here somewhere. There it is. Rabbi Alexander said, if a conceited person suffers even a minor problem, it will uproot him. Isn't that something? It will uproot him. So here's some points to remember. Those are the five major things. I'll review them. Number one, the ego is all about making myself right and others wrong. Two, the ego causes feelings of superiority and inferiority. Number three, the ego equates having with being. Four, the ego equates doing with being. And five, the ego is the cause of all depression and unhappiness. Here are a few extra points just to keep in mind. The ego is a phantom soul. It's not real. It's a lie. It's satanic. It's a false you. It's not the real you. It's a you you've manufactured, maybe without not even knowing it. And you know, with children, with children who play pretend, you know, one day they're the cowboy, next day they're the Indian, next day they're an astronaut, next day they're a soldier, next day they're who, you know, they put on these things. They get into junior high school, and having taught junior high for 18 years, I'd see the same kid come into class every day, and each day it's not the same kid. He must have watched a James Bond movie the night before, because now he comes in real cool, like a secret agent man. That night he watches a comedy. He comes in trying to be Mr. Hilarious. The next night, maybe he's watching a sports show, and he comes in holding his arms out like his muscles are too big to put his hands in his pockets, you know? And every day it's this new persona he's putting on. You know, when you become an adult, though, put away childish things. Become you. Quit putting on ego. And yet, the ego can be so tight and so interwoven with the way we think, we are not even aware it's there. But it is a phantom, it is a lie, and it's actually satanic. And it is a barrier between you being in connection with another person, even with God, in an intimate way. Yes, Robin, saw your hand up. How do we deal with the ego? First of all, recognizing what it is, recognizing it's there. See, a lot of us will go around and say, well, I'm not bragging about myself, therefore I must not be very egotistical. And that can be the ego saying that, right? First of all, recognizing that the ego is it's part of what we've inherited from Adam and Eve, recognizing that it's there. And every time we become unhappy and miserable, self-pitying, to realize that's because my ego is suffering. And then laugh, realize, and let it go. Let it go. Because one of the points I want to make here is that the detachment from ego can take place almost instantaneously. Now, it can come back, too. But you can just say, I'm turning that off. I'm just not going to do that anymore. Be content to be a nobody. And just be yourself. Learn to listen and not talk all the time. You know what I'm saying? Learn to rest. Not always have to be the one out in front. Be patient. Learn to wait. Instead of always having to be one that be the first to act. But here are a few points. As we go through it, more of these will come up. The ego's primary job is to hide you from view. And it does this by drawing attention to itself. Their ego's primary job is to hide you from view and to draw attention to itself. Ego can affect the way you dress. I've talked about dress before, clothing. You should never dress in a way to draw attention to yourself. Because if you dress in a way that makes people look at you, that's ego. And if you're offended by that remark, that's definitely ego. We should dress in such a way that if people do look down at what we're wearing, they immediately tell themselves, all right, nothing to see here. Our clothing should say, nothing to see here. Go back up and look at the face. Because it's the face of the person that reveals the person. And so many times we dress in a way to distract people away from us. You see what I'm saying? And our clothing should basically make us invisible. We should dress clean and modestly and nice clothes. But if it's something that's loud and glaring to draw attention, that's ego. That's ego. People should notice us, not our clothing. It says, since the fall, man has lacked a natural connection to God's neshama, God's soul. So man has felt this most severely and tries to fill the lack by simulating its presence. This imitation is a phantom soul called ego. In other words, we want that true connection, heartfelt connection with God, intimate connection with God, because we don't feel it. We don't feel it. We make this phantom soul around us. This goes back to Robin's question, how do we deal with the ego? Maintain an intimate, real, genuine, strong connection to God. Make the awareness of Him His reality. See everything in the world around you in the context of God's the Creator and He's running the world. As we constantly do that, the ego just kind of evaporates away. For the sake of time, I'm not going to take any more questions. I'm sorry. I see some hands up. A few more points to go through because we are running over time. But also, ego being a phantom soul, though it feels real and genuine, prevents one from discerning between fantasy and reality. Let me say that again. Ego being a phantom soul, though it feels real and genuine, prevents one from discerning between fantasy and reality. A person living out of the ego is living a lie. Therefore, it is very difficult for him to discern between reality and falsehood. A person who's truly humble, a person whose ego has been dealt with, can become very discerning into looking into others because they're not distracted by the ego. They see to the heart of the issue. Yeshua had, he's the only person in history who had no ego, zero ego. None. And it says he had no man to tell him. He needed no man to tell him what was in the heart. He could see what was in the heart of a man. He could see right to the core of the person asking the question or making the statement. Oh, can you imagine if we had no ego? We had the connection with God like Yeshua had. How we could read people and minister to them, see into them, and truly help them. The ego's primary job is to hide you from view and draw attention to itself. In fact, it will try to convince you that it is you. The ego will try to convince you that it is you, but it isn't. One of the wisest things I ever read is a rabbi who said, when someone comes and belittles you and attacks you, and you feel all hot and bothered and upset by it, he said that person's doing you an enormous favor because they're attacking the ego. Let them. Let the ego take the beating for you. Let the ego be destroyed by that. Because God has sent that person who's saying negative things against you and trying to hurt you with their words, God has sent them to attack your ego. Don't take it personally. They're doing you a favor. They're blowing the bars off of your cell that you've built around yourself. Let them have at it. And respond with humility. Can we do that? But if you think the ego really is you, you're going to take it all personally and get all upset and mad and angry, lose your peace. Remember, the ego is a source of all unhappiness and depression. Here's another point. Nothing makes the ego more uncomfortable than someone who can see through it. Nothing makes the ego more uncomfortable than someone who can see through it. Rabbi Kasida said, the master of the universe declares, I and an egotistical person cannot both be in the same world. You know, you can have people sitting in the same pew next to each other, but you're living in different worlds. Your bodies are here in this physical realm, but your souls can be in completely, utterly different worlds. One soul can be living in darkness and pride and the smothering dimension of the ego. Another can be living in the light and in the freedom of humility. Ego is the primary hindrance to knowing God. This is why so many of the scribes and Pharisees, high priests, just could not recognize Yeshua. Their egos. One man said, ego is the static in our spiritual receptors. It's the static. The part of you that is able to recognize the ego is the same part that is able to recognize God. I love that one. The part of you that right now is able to recognize your own ego, that's the part of you that can also recognize God. Because the ego has no relationship with God. It can be very religious. It can be very religious. In fact, religion is something the ego might choose to put on to build itself up. But the part of you that can recognize the ego in you is the same part of you that can recognize God and know Him. You know, if you're sitting here this morning or listening on the internet or whatever, you're thinking, oh, this doesn't apply to me. And you're probably the most egotistical person sitting here today or listening on the internet. Because I'm teaching this and it applies to me. Humility is a source of oneness with another and with God. Humility is a source of oneness with the other and with God. And then, as I said earlier, the detachment from the ego can take place almost instantaneously. The ego hates exposure, hates being exposed for what it is. This is why when people recognize you're a fraud, you're not as smart as you think. You're not as athletic as you think. You're not as whatever as you think. It's agonizing to us, right? The ego hates exposure. But when we on the inside realize, yeah, I'm not as smart as other people. I'm not as rich as other people, not as good looking as other people, not as capable as other people, not as talented as other people. And you're okay with it. Let's let it go. Then you realize, but I'm unique. And the combination of talents and the quality, the quantity of talents I have, the degree which I have them, is a unique combination that God has made. So, Father, here I am. What do you want of me to do? Let's get the ego out of the way. And oh my goodness, you become the true you. When you just follow the ego, you basically become a clone. You just put on a prison uniform, your cell's like everybody else's, you're just a number. But when the ego goes away, then you become you. You become something utterly unique in the universe. You become free. The depression, the unhappiness, all that kind of pain, it just kind of evaporates because the lie is gone. I had one more quote. I had a quote from Satan. I love this quote. It's not in the Bible. It's from a book that is supposedly an autobiography of Satan, where he's kind of letting us in on his secrets and how he works. And Satan says this, "Let go of the ego, and I'll let go of you. Let go of the ego, and I'll let go of you." That's pretty powerful. Our time is gone. Let's close in prayer. Our Father and King, Lord, all these things that we've been talking, sharing about are all really right out of the Scriptures. Because we see every issue and every difficulty from Genesis to Revelation as coming out of human beings and even Satan himself, putting self first. Choosing to live a lie, to project some phantom mirage of who we think we would like to be and what we want others to think we are. And it's all deception. It's all a lie. It's all nothing. And yet it causes so much pain. It causes so much destruction. It breaks so many relationships. It's so divisive. So, Father, I pray you'd help us to be living sacrifices. That we just let go of this burden of ego. That we just learn to humble ourselves in your in your eyes. And we'll leave all the lifting up to you. We'll let you lift us up in due time as you see fit. Lord, I pray you'd set us free. Make us truly, indeed, free. For the one person in the world, whoever lived on this earth, who had no ego, is the one person that everybody in the world talks about, and that's our Messiah, Yeshua. Lord, I pray, help us to be more like him. When we see how humble he was, how little he pushed himself forward, but he could see himself truly as he was. And he could see others as they are. Lord, help us to be that. Help us to be honest. And Lord, I pray that as we let go of the ego, our enemy would let go of us. We experience true freedom. Lord, we thank you that this is possible. We thank you for the light of your word that exposes this falseness, this phantom soul in our own lives. So Lord, let us take the information we've heard and learned, and then to behave like grown-ups, as free people who leave our egos in the dust, and we can walk with a face that's lifted up to you. Lord, make us this kind of people, for I know this is your desire. And Lord, we're counting on you to help us do this. And we ask it in Yeshua's name. Amen.